humiliated and stupid. He got angry and defiant again, and then, abruptly, it was over. Back at the MCC, he was strip-searched. After previous proffers, marshals had caught prisoners with pens, paper clips, even a foot-long Subway sandwich tucked inside the front of someone's underwear. The attorney whose sandwich it was said he'd lost his appetite when the marshals offered to return it to him. Once in his cell, Shug turned the encounter over in his mind and felt it had gone badly. Nothing happened for a week. O'Malley and La Barbera read the situation differently and felt the meeting had gone well and that Shug had told the truth under pressure. He had been honest right from the get-go. They always spoke about the crime the defendant was charged with first as a test of probity. He might have thought of playing games like they all did, but he hadn't. O'Malley told La Barbera that he thought Shug would be an excellent witness. He suggested they bring him back. At the second meeting, they all had pizza together. O'Malley felt breaking bread in these situations solidified the deal. He explained that Shug might be offered a cooperation agreement, but that he would have to plead guilty to everything he had ever done. After that, La Barbera would write a 5K letter, so-called because of Section 5K1.1 of the U.S. Sentencing Guidelines, on his behalf. It was a request for leniency from the judge for his substantial assistance to the prosecution. And that was it. No promises. "If you fuck us, we're going to fuck you back so bad you'll never get over it," O'Malley said. "I catch you lying, we're going to tear that agreement up. You'll have pled guilty, but you'll be on your own." "Okay," said Shug. "What do you want to know?" The proffer sessions went on for hours at a time. La Barbera thought that Shug resembled a hyperactive cartoon character. He described acts of violence cinematically, with frenzied onomatopoeia and a boyish sense of pride. She'd never encountered anyone quite so raw. He went from volatile to sanguine in seconds and back again. Sometimes he spoke fast, offering dense color and detail, providing atmosphere without adding to a factual sequence of events. He wanted to show that he was a tough guy, and he seemed interested in saving face. Other sex money murder cooperators often just gave up the facts in a natural and unguarded fashion. Shug's posturing got in the way. At the next session, O'Malley walked in with a slim file. "What do you know about Baby Jay?" Shug's heart rose in his throat. He'd been dreading giving up Baby, and had obfuscated every time his name was mentioned. O'Malley opened the file for Shug. Inside lay a single picture of Baby. As the investigator pressed for details, Shug lost his temper when they implied that he was lying. He slammed the table, kicked his chair back, and raged. He looked as if he were about to hurt someone, and for the first time La Barbera felt physically threatened by a cooperator. She was relieved when O'Malley and Forselli put the handcuffs on and he was restrained. The marshals took him back, and La Barbera gratefully returned to her office just around the corner. The next day they asked again, and on it went, with Shug often fudging and holding back or shading the truth. La Barbera realized that Shug saw no moral value in turning down a drug deal over taking one, or resisting violence versus enforcing it. He didn't understand the distinction, and for that reason she felt little hope he might ever be redeemed. All the while, they were probing the limits of his knowledge and his truthfulness, throwing in the odd question they knew the answer to. Shug didn't want to give up Baby. O'Malley demanded answers. It was all or nothing. His agreement would be void if he held anything back. Slowly and reluctantly, Shug shared what he knew about his old friend. Over several sessions, O'Malley's file grew fatter with more papers and information. Next, they pressed about BMO. Shug squirmed, deeply uncomfortable. He had no choice but to talk about the murders of Chiron and Joe Dix. When they were done, Forselli escorted Shug back over the bridge. They chatted about the neighborhood. The conversation turned to the murder of Fat Mike 10 years earlier. Forselli said he had been called to the scene. Shug pushed him for details of Fat Mike's death. Forselli volunteered one or two pieces of information which took Shug by surprise. Forselli asked how Shug's family was holding up. No one had ever asked Shug how he was doing before. He was taken aback. O'Malley and Forselli had warned Shug that his cellmates would be suspicious. If anyone discovered he was ratting, they'd kill him. O'Malley always made sure that no one saw him coming down with them, and he offered Shug excuses to take back to the block. Say the motherfuckers just hit you with more charges. The more O'Malley worked with La Barbera on the case, the more his view of cooperators changed. He always tried to buck his cynicism when Glazer talked about Weed and Seed, the federal program to remove gangs from neighborhoods and inject funds for renewal, and he avoided all meetings with social workers and community do-gooders. His job was to seek out the truth and to lock the bad guys up to stop the killing. But La Barbera brought out the humanity in some of these young men from Soundview. At first, men like Roe tested her with vulgar language or stories of their sexual conquests designed to shock. But in a few months, she'd picked up their jargon and now threw back their own street slang to disarm them. When prosecutors adopted the argot of the street, O'Malley smiled inwardly because it signified to him that his mentorship had been successful. Over time, many of the young SMM men came to respect her and didn't want to let her down. It was extraordinary. O'Malley, by contrast, had trouble getting past the lack of remorse in these killers. It was the one part of the process that never figured for him. Killing was a job, or an obligation, a duty, or the outlet for their rage. But he struggled with how little they seemed to notice or mourn for the humanity of those they'd killed. Shug was charming at times, but he had no remorse. He was more preoccupied with Pete's betrayal than he was with taking a life. Shug grew more comfortable as more sessions passed. He mistakenly read O'Malley as the steel gauntlet, La Barbera as the velvet glove. And O'Malley had never met a young gangster quite so charismatic and funny. "I'm cool as a fan, yo," he'd say when they asked how he was before they started. He joked sometimes when the going got tough, flashing that incomparable charm. "Yo, Nicky," he'd say, winking at Nicole. "Let me holler at you off the record on that one." They'd enjoy the levity for a bit, but La Barbera would circle back and press him as hard as O'Malley. "Look, you're lying," she'd say. "There's no point carrying on with this anymore." Shug bristled angrily, held back, flourished his pride. He fought the urge to call her a bitch. He went back to the cells each time, thinking he was making a big mistake. He knew he could be killed for what he was doing. But over half a dozen meetings, he found his confessions liberating. O'Malley just listened. He never judged. He never acted shocked. You could tell him anything. For months, one question sat on his mind. Was Twin a snitch? Weeks into the meetings, he asked them directly. "No," said La Barbera. "He probably would have been on this indictment if he was alive." Shug pushed his chair back furiously. He was going to give Pete 30 years of his life for a lie? After the session, Forselli took him back to the cell. The detective saw the anger and frustration brimming over. "I loved Pete," said Shug to the detective. "I still do. But he ain't loved me." He found it easier to give up sex money murder after that. "Listen, Shug," O'Malley said. "If I ever find you withholding something, you and I are going to have a serious problem." He sensed that Shug was still holding back on BMO and Baby J. "How many bodies you got in Springfield?" "None," Shug said. He might have shot at a few people, but he'd missed. "Right," said O'Malley. "That's attempted murder." Shug pressed on, but he began to hate the sessions. Back in MCC, he reined in the violent urges, but he couldn't stay completely out of trouble. He got into fistfights. One day, settling into his chair in the proffer session, grinning at La Barbera and ready to start work, he was caught off guard when O'Malley lunged across the table. "What the fuck is your problem, Shug? You're not a sex-money-murder gangster anymore. You're a cooperating witness now. You cannot knock people around." Shug sat in his seat, humbled. O'Malley pressed on. I got your balls in my hand, Shug. Sometime in early 1999, Shug went to court with Pete and his remaining co-defendants. In the bullpen with his old friend, Shug finally confided. Something gotta give, Mo, Shug said. I ain't feeling this no more. Pete offered his usual knowing calm. Be all right, he said. He didn't realize that Shug had just said goodbye. Finally, after an extended period of doubt, Shug gave himself over entirely to O'Malley and La Barbera. They weren't friends, that was clear, but there was respect. O'Malley, with Shug's permission, called Shug's grandmother to tell her that he was cooperating and that he might have a chance to turn his life around. It don't matter, she barked. She never came to visit. And in time, Shug's baby mother stopped coming, too. La Barbera and O'Malley wrote a detailed memo about Shug and all his criminal acts. It stated what Shug would plead guilty to if he went before a judge, and, crucially, what he would be able to do for the prosecution if he was formally signed up as a cooperator. The memo went to two deputy chiefs in the criminal division who signed off on it, satisfied that Shug could provide invaluable support to the prosecution. On April 29, 1999, Shug was led into Judge Cederbaum's courtroom to admit his crimes. Alone, without his co-defendants, he stood behind the defendant's table with Martin Siegel. He caught sight of O'Malley. Their eyes met. Shug knew what he had to do. He admitted all of it—racketeering, murder, distribution of narcotics. It was over quickly. Afterward, he signed a formal cooperation agreement. His fate would now rest entirely in the hands of the judge who might be swayed by La Barbera, who he hoped would write a strong 5K letter. Afterward, Shug was taken back to the hole for his safety. His plea was sealed so that it couldn't be seen by his co-defendants or their attorneys. For O'Malley, the days after a defendant pled guilty were fraught. Other inmates might suspect that an inmate was cooperating, but when they pled out, there was no doubt. In complex multi-defendant gang cases, O'Malley did his best to keep everyone separate. After a plea, the hole was the only place cooperators were safe. La Barbera suggested that Shug think about going into the Federal Witness Protection Program, known as WITSEC. They'd heard from other cooperators that Shug was now food in the language of the Bloods. Gang members had a duty to try to kill him for his treason, and anyone who passed up the chance could be targeted for failing to live up to Blood protocol. Shug decided to enter the program. He took a polygraph test. An examiner asked if he harbored any ill will toward other cooperators, the judge, or the prosecutors. Some prisoners tried to get into WITSEC segregation units just to be able to kill co-defendants on their cases. Shug passed and was moved to a specially constructed third-floor unit of the MCC, a prison within a prison, with its own security entrance. He was given an alias as soon as he arrived. Only the warden of the prison knew the real names of the inmates. Visitors had to stand in front of a two-way mirror so that cooperators could first see who came to see them before they were granted access. A prison guard selected random trays of food from the mess hall for the WITSEC unit to prevent poisoning. Life in WITSEC took on a far more benign aspect. Cooperators could relax among their own. The deeply etched alliances based on race or gang affiliation that were crucial in the general population were erased in the unit. Italian mobsters mixed with Jamaican gangsters, and Aryan Brotherhood members mixed with Black Bronx street crew members like Shug. But Shug struggled with his bland surroundings and asked to be moved to a different prison. La Barbera found him a place in Arizona. There, an Aryan Brotherhood turncoat whom Shug befriended called him a nigger while they were playing cards. Shug punched him in the mouth and opened a wound that would need 5 stitches. He wound up back in the MCC. He joined Alcoholics Anonymous because they taught public speaking and he wanted to excel on the stand. He told O'Malley and La Barbera that he would stare Pete down for his betrayal. But La Barbera worried about Shug on the stand. She felt that jurors wouldn't find him at all likable, and his easily provoked temper would offer a soft target for a defense lawyer. Meanwhile, Shug readied for a showdown with his old friend. 6. Myth's End. In May 1999, Pipe was called to a meeting with senior prison staff in Cayuga. He suspected it was due to his rising reputation for violence after he had recently ordered an attack against some food, an inmate who had assaulted a blood. He was slashed so severely with a razor that he needed 100 stitches and staples to put his face back together. Prison staff wondered if Pipe wanted to be moved into protective custody. "Why would I want to do that?" They told him that his brother might be cooperating and that therefore Pipe could be targeted. "Do you know who the fuck I am?" Pipe responded. "I'm the fucking OG. I ain't need no protection. Motherfuckers need to be protected from me, yo." Pipe left the meeting puzzled. His brother cooperating? He didn't have much time to dwell on the news before the guards returned and found an ice pick Pipe had secreted in one of the boxes of rice he also used to hide contraband. One of the Bloods had snitched on him for having the weapon. Pipe was sent to the Special Housing Unit, SHU, in the Auburn Correctional Facility, a maximum security prison. Alone, he ruminated. News of his brother's betrayal began to corrode his thoughts. How could Roe have turned, particularly on Pete, who was family? Someone must have gotten to him. Pipe got his answer a few weeks later when an investigator with the Southern District showed up. Pipe was led into an interview room where he encountered a tall, graying man in a sport coat. Pipe was offered a chair and, after sitting down, immediately pushed it back onto its two rear legs to show sullen contempt. O'Malley started in on his pitch. O'Malley thought that he might be able to bluff Pipe. He wouldn't flip right away, but he might respond to the realization that he was being watched and that he would one day be apprehended. O'Malley wanted to get inside his head. After the meeting, they'd monitor his calls and see if that opened fresh leads. O'Malley said that guys were being arrested every day and that he knew the whole story because Roe was cooperating. Pipe could help himself by telling what he knew. "If you don't," said O'Malley, "I'm going to get you anyway, so it doesn't make much difference." Pipe sprang forward in his chair. "Let me explain something to you, Mr. John O'Malley, or whatever the fuck your name is. If you had any type of information on me, you wouldn't be up in here talking to me, cocksucker. You'd be here to lock me up." O'Malley sat still and blank-faced. "So go get some more information, man, and don't come here no more trying to see me, right? My brother? He's a grown man, and I'm pretty sure he knew the consequences behind what he was doing. So you go tell him to cooperate. I ain't telling him shit. Now get the fuck out of here." O'Malley stood up, looming over Pipe. "Once we finish decoding those letters, and we find out you gave the okay to have David Mullins killed, we're going to come and get you." A pause, and a face-off. The investigator concluded, "Remember what I told you." Pipe smirked. O'Malley handed Pipe a business card. The gangster looked at it, tore it up, and threw it back. "Whatever the fuck you say," he said. The guards came to take him away. But Pipe was deeply rattled. In the exercise yard that day, he burned every one of Pete's letters and watched the smoke drift away over the wire. A few months later, in October 1999, Pipe was released from prison on 22 months of parole. On Halloween, dressed all in black, black hoodie, black Levi's, and black suede Timberland boots, he arrived in Soundview. After a quick tour of the neighborhood, he made his way to his sister's new apartment on East 182nd and Walton, just west of the Bronx Zoo. A banner across the living room proclaimed, "Welcome home, Big Brother." There were cheers, music, and libations for the new head of sex money murder. 22-year-old Pipe surveyed the room and the homies who looked at him now with the same reverence they had given to Pistol Pete. The feds had arrested the entire first generation of the gang. The new generation would have to live up to the reputation of the founding fathers. None had done murders with Pipe and developed that communion from bloodshed. In the swim of callow faces at the party, Pipe tried to remember all the street names. Strong, Ghost, Gorgeous Indian, Venom, and his brother Babyface Gangsta. He was apprehensive about the new breed. Worse? Pipe had left prison broke. B-Love had been holding most of his money, but with his arrest those funds became unavailable. And Twin, the man who was going to set him up back in the drug game, had been murdered on Pete's orders. Finally, Sex Money Murder had been dismantled as a money-making machine, the contacts and distribution networks all destroyed by the feds. Pipe would have to build the gang from scratch. He'd need a serious gunman, others who were good with money, and hard-working hustlers on the lower tier. For most of his sentence, Pipe had had a picture of Jonelle in her bikini up on the wall, and it was understood by both that they would resume their relationship when he got out. She snuggled up to him as the party wound down in the early morning hours. There had once been an ugly scene in the prison visiting room when Pipe's sister, who'd brought Jonelle up one day, told him that his girlfriend had been sleeping with another man in the projects. But they had mostly smoothed it over, and after everyone left, they had their reunion amid the streamers and empty champagne bottles. Pipe saw Pete in person, the first time since 1995, at One Foley Square when Pete was produced for an appeal of his North Carolina conviction. Pipe arrived at the courthouse, handed over his ID to the marshal at the door, and took a seat in the public gallery. Pete, at the table with his lawyer, caught sight of Pipe and gave a wide grin and then a flat line from his heart. Pipe returned the salute. But the smiles evaporated when Pipe caught sight of O'Malley standing discreetly to one side, back to the wall. He'd seen the tributes the men had offered each other. The next time Pipe went to meet his parole officer, he briefly caught sight of O'Malley at the office. The officer relayed the news that Pipe would be reassigned from regular parole to a more draconian and restrictive regime reserved for gang members. When Pipe asked why, he was told that he'd been seen associating with a known felon, Peter Rolock. Pipe now realized why O'Malley had been there to visit his parole officer. In the parole office, Pipe was shown some of the evidence the feds had against him. A chart described links between the Sex Money Murder Bloods, with a picture of Pipe at the top. Below were his three top-tier leaders. O'Malley was refocusing his attack from Pistol Pete and the original crew to the new OG of Sex Money Murder. Out on the street, cops were harassing everyone. Pipe and some of the others were playing dice in the lobby of 551 when the police descended. One of the Bloods protested they were disrupting a friendly game. They were all charged with trespassing and bused to the 43rd Precinct's holding cells. A summons received while on supervised release could get Pipe thrown back in prison. Some of the policemen came down to the cells and tried to instigate a fight. "You Blood guys think you're tough, but you're just a bunch of pussies," said one. Another attempted to get Pipe to swing at him. "So you're the new OG, huh? Come on, take a shot. Let's see how tough you are." Pipe controlled his temper. The Bloods were booked and released. Back on the block, the next couple of weeks passed in a blur of parties. Women from all over the projects tried to get close to Pipe. He was broke, but as OG of Sex Money Murder, they knew he wielded power that he'd eventually turn into cash. One night, Chantal, a smart and lovable single mother 5 years Pipe senior, with two sons he had known for years, offered to cook for him. She made him rice and beans and then made her play, suggesting that he move in with her and help the family out financially. In return, she could offer him a base right in the heart of the neighborhood. A dim promise of a romantic liaison formed part of the pitch, but for the most part she was proposing a practical arrangement. Chantal had grown up in Soundview and remembered her mother being terrified of even going to the store. Living with a new OG of Sex Money Murder would bestow safety on her family. At first, Pipe resisted. "I ain't down like that," he said. But in a day or two, he fell under her spell. He moved into her seventh-floor apartment at 1669 Randall Avenue and dumped Jonelle. As the winter gloom descended, he discovered that Soundview could be more dangerous than when Pete was on the street. The dissolution of Sex Money Murder after the federal onslaught had left a vacuum. Young guns were looking to make a name. The first indication came when Pipe caught sight of BMO pushing himself up the block in a wheelchair. A few weeks before, BMO had been waiting for the elevator in his building when he was confronted by a young gangster brandishing a gun. He was shot 9 times in the legs. Avoiding the hospital because he didn't want to risk being questioned by the police, he was nursed back to health by B-Love's mother. Rumors circulated that the shooting was payback for Thanksgiving Day, which everyone assumed BMO had been involved in because he was so tight with SMM. BMO returned to Kingston, where he was robbed in his wheelchair. The thieves even took his sneakers. When he was picked up by Kingston cops on a drug-dealing warrant, he bemoaned the lack of respect among the new generation of gangsters. "These kids are wilding out," he complained. On the block, Pipe struggled to control the small, rambunctious, and ill-disciplined army that was Sex Money Murder. It seemed every male of fighting age in the neighborhood wanted to fly under the banner of the United Blood Nation. Back in the day, when SMM was an operation of maybe 12 members, there was authentic loyalty. When Pete killed Cato for Twin, or Twin killed Barnes for Pete, it was seen as a demonstration of selflessness and a dedication to the family. The Thanksgiving murder had torn that myth apart, exposing the brute selfishness and jealousy at the heart of the organization. If the top leaders like Pete could betray and murder their own, who was truly safe? And now Pipe controlled 40 or more Bloods, far bigger than the original team, but most of them just restive kids. No one really knew who was who. Cab drivers were robbed and pistol-whipped, gold chains were snatched from residents. They had ongoing feuds with each other, shooting up one another's houses, but a will to take on those who disrespected Sex Money Murder was absent. Pipe was driving past the White Castle when he spotted a rival young gun from Bronxdale. A few months earlier, while Pipe was in prison, the man had bicycled into Soundview and shot at 3 Bloods before riding home. Pipe knew the man. He approached him, and the two embraced. "I got respect for you and Pete," said the man by way of apology. They exchanged friendly words before Pipe headed back to Soundview, where he found the Bloods the man had shot at. Pipe had been rocking him to sleep, and only drew him into a hug to see if he was strapped. He told the Bloods he had located the culprit, and further, he was in the White Castle unarmed. It was a perfect opportunity for revenge. But the Bloods were all too scared to do anything. Disgusted with how weak they made SMM look, Pipe thought about shooting the man himself. They talked him out of it. "If you get knocked, we lost the OG," they complained. Disgusted, Pipe gave up on the whole thing. In Pipe's absence, Soundview's distrust of the police had reached a new low. On February 4, 1999, 22-year-old Amadou Diallo had been shot 19 times by 4 NYPD officers from the Elite Street Crimes Unit as he stood in the doorway of his apartment on Wheeler Avenue, reaching for his wallet. Charged with second-degree murder and reckless endangerment, officers Kenneth Boss, Sean Carroll, Edward McMillan, and Richard Murphy were all eventually acquitted. Soundview hit the front pages once more. For Sex Money Murder, the rancor over the Thanksgiving shootings continued nearly unabated after 2 years. Pipe stood on the block one day to see the remaining twin, Damon Mullins, drive around a corner and head toward him. In the weeks after the murder, news had spread that Damon was going to retaliate and therefore should be shot on sight. But nobody followed the order. Everyone had loved his brother. As Damon drove up, Pipe eased back on the hammer of the gun in his pocket. The window rolled down. "You okay?" said Damon. Pipe nodded. Damon drifted off. A few weeks later, Damon left the neighborhood and moved down south. Meanwhile, Pipe had set about establishing a fledgling drug empire on his own by ordering a local hustler, Midnight, selling in breach of SMM regulations, to give him half his profits within a few days of his return to Soundview. After about 2 months, Pipe had amassed $10,000 from the arrangement, and he simply ordered Midnight to leave the block. Now Pipe had enough to get started. He selected 3 men to be his lieutenants: his cousin Scruff, Bear's younger brother CB, and Fat Daddy, a short, overweight hustler who was something of a homebody but had an aptitude for cooking up crack. Pipe devised a way to keep his hands clean so as not to breach his probation, but to still have the profits rolling back to him. He suggested that each of them put in $3,000 for a total of $12,000 for half a kilo. Fat Daddy and a young gangster named G.I. bought the cocaine. They hooked up with a crackhead, offering him free product in exchange for the use of his apartment in Academy Gardens, where Fat Daddy did the cooking. And then they bagged it up for the 15 or so hustlers who would sell on the street. Carefully, Pipe annotated every detail of inflow and outflow, both cash and product, in a spiral-bound notebook, using code in case the police ever got hold of it. $1,000 worth of crack was detailed as one white T-shirt. He knew who was given how many white T-shirts to hustle and what their returns were. Pipe took a 70% profit from every batch. Within 5 months, things were up and running. Every morning he went to the store for coffee and checked his hustlers. Then he retired to Chantal's apartment, where each night he stashed his money and a .45-caliber Ruger in a charcoal-colored safe hidden in the bedroom closet. After a good day on the block, he might sink into a bubble bath Chantal had run for him and sip Hennessy. For the first time since he'd been a teenager, he eschewed marijuana. He needed to be on point. There was little time to relax, though. The neighborhood was now deemed a federal block, under surveillance by the feds. Rumors circulated that even the sidewalks were bugged, so the crew spoke mostly in blood code. For years they'd operated in defiance of the police, but everyone was truly scared of the feds. And it was clear that there were rats in their midst. Those in the neighborhood knew that Cod had betrayed Pete, and Pipe wasn't surprised by it. George Wallace had always told Pete to eliminate him, and now Cod's weakness had been Pete's downfall. But if a top lieutenant could be so weak, it meant anyone could be an informant. Pipe himself didn't trust anyone, even family. Things got worse when Pipe was given handwritten documents that detailed statements B-Love had made to federal prosecutors, among them a claim fingering Nut as having shot a Puerto Rican kid on the block, meaning Tony Morton. Mac 11, facing federal charges and in prison, had obtained the documents and passed them on to his brother, who immediately turned them over to Pipe. An emergency meeting was held to try to deal with the new threat that federal prosecutors would come after them for more murders. "He's sitting on me," complained Nut, fearfully, meaning that B-Love could testify against him in court. B-Love was going to be a devastating witness against Pete in his upcoming trial. One of Pete's lawyers, Abraham Moskowitz, a former Southern District prosecutor, called Pipe and asked him to come to his office on 7th Avenue in Manhattan to talk about undermining B-Love's credibility on the stand. If they could catch him in a lie and unearth crimes he had committed that he had not told the investigators about, they could destroy him in court. At the meeting, Pipe was advised to think carefully about helping Pete. His participation could easily draw him into the dragnet. If he was called to testify, there was a good chance that his involvement in the North Carolina drug operation would be revealed. "I don't care," said Pipe. "That's my man." Pete's legal team passed Pipe a message. "Pete says he loves you, tells you to keep your head up." A few weeks later, Pipe met the lawyers again. This time they produced an old letter from Pete. Pipe had had no reply to the last letter he'd sent Pete from Cayuga, but in fact Pete had responded. His response had been seized in the jailhouse and was never sent. In code, it began by stating how much Pete loved Pipe. It went on to complain about the feds and their work to take down SMM. Pete wondered if information from Cod had implicated Pipe. "Whack is on some 999 shit and has skylined them females about the Mad Hatter, 101, and the rest of the fam." He went on. "So keep reading, because I don't know if he skylined about the Mad Hatter passing off drop top with Carmine Lilo Galante," meaning Pipe, "or what." Pete seemed panicked about the seriousness of the situation. "So far they are trying to charge the Mad Hatter with 5 Peter rolls, and they are saying had real rights flip the clip on Thanksgiving Day." Pete was being charged with 5 murders along with the shootings on Thanksgiving. He claimed, falsely, that a new indictment would involve as many as 74 members of Sex Money Murder. Pete sent word to the neighborhood that everyone was to be armed at all times. "It's time for everybody to play their positions. If it's going down, let's make a whole lot of noise and take care of all of them. Take out orders. Every one of them 999s, Flintstones, or Shining Stars, so put the word out." That is, if Sex Money Murder is going down, they need to go out with a bang. Be advised that all the cooperators' children are to be killed. Pete had finally lost his mind. There had been rumors of gangsters killing the families of their enemies, but no one had done it. Pipe wasn't falling for it. It looked to Pipe as if Pete wanted to bring everyone into prison with him. When Pipe had finished translating the letter for the lawyers, there was silence. One of the lawyers said that Pipe was lucky not to have received it. An investigator hired by the defense couriered messages between Pete and the executive OG. He told Pipe that Pete said there were at least 23 confidential informants operating between Castle Hill and Soundview. Pete's mother reiterated the message a few weeks later. "The block's hot," she warned Pipe. "Be careful." Pipe took some solace from the comforts of his home with Chantal and from a rampaging sex life elsewhere. He became a surrogate father to Chantal's 2 boys, 6 and 7, lavishing attention on them and taking them to City Island and Rockaway Beach for Sunday lunches. He dropped them off at school in the morning, enjoying his fatherly role. In between drug work, his driver delivered mistresses to him from all over the projects. Women sensed the cash he might spoil them with. One answered the door to him naked, and once some young women even came up from Brooklyn to meet him. Pipe took the women he favored to a motel on Boston Road. Then he returned to the block and checked on the day's drug sales before spending the afternoon with Chantal and picking the children up from school. In the evenings, he often arranged more trysts at the motel. About $10,000 a week flowed in and was deposited in the safe, which was as large as a nightstand. Only he, Chantal, and 2 others had the combination. Chantal needed to be able to access cash in case Pipe needed bail money. Nicole LaBarbera prepped a cooperator for trial at a remote prison in Pennsylvania. She had moved him there because there were threats against him in New York for cooperating against Pistol Pete. He was terrified, trapped between 2 frightening worlds, the severity of federal justice and now potential fatal retaliation for becoming a snitch among his own. She hoped that he might relax a little away from the chaos at MCC. Yet the sounds of animals in the woods and owls at night beyond the high fences spooked him. When the cooperator turned 21, LaBarbera ordered him a cupcake from the commissary. She felt despair that a man this young was leaving his childhood behind in a federal prison, and all she could do was bring him a cupcake. When she was alone with him and he stopped projecting menace and power, drawing from the pack instinct of being with his co-defendants, she saw that he now wanted a different life. Arduous proffer sessions were, for some, like being a penitent at confession, and she could see that there was a glimmer of atonement in the process as these violent young men confided in her and O'Malley. LaBarbera hoped that the contact with her could show these young men that there were people in the world who could be counted on to say and do truthful things. She was saddened that the cooperator lived in a world where he was unable to form emotional attachments, which were viewed as a vulnerability. His story and how young some of these men in SMM were weighed on her. It was a feeling she expressed to her husband, Prosecutor David Kelly, chief of the Organized Crime and Terrorism Unit, who had prosecuted major cases such as that of Ramzi Youssef, who bombed the World Trade Center in 1993. Some of the violence she heard about in the proffers or saw in photographs, like the one of Kenyon Jenkins' baseball hat filled with blood as he lay on the sidewalk, had become lodged in her mind. She couldn't shake them, unlike her husband and O'Malley, who could compartmentalize their work and move on. One evening, after another meeting with the cooperator, she returned to her motel near the prison and got a surprise phone call from U.S. Attorney Mary Jo White. White informed her that she had received a call from Peter Rolock's lawyers. With just a few days before his trial was due to start, Rolock wanted to plead guilty on the condition that the government drop its request for the death penalty. Over the next few weeks, a deal was hammered out. While Barbera felt that Pete should be allowed to plead, but on the condition that he spend the first 18 months of his sentence in solitary confinement so that he could no longer order hits from jail. After that, the rules of his confinement would be reviewed by the court and the Bureau of Prisons. His lawyers agreed to the stipulation, which surprised La Barbera. On January 4, 2000, Peter Rolock entered Judge Cederbaum's court just after 3 p.m., dressed soberly in glasses and a suit and tie. Affecting a studious air, he referred to Cederbaum as ma'am, and his lawyers made much of his politeness, his likability as a client, and how he had no infractions since he had been in prison. But now the road had ended, and he would have to confess to who he really was. He rose at the defense table alone. All of his closest lieutenants had deserted him. Judge Cederbaum demanded answers. The prosecution team was taken aback at his candor in discussing the murders. Judge Cederbaum asked about his first murder, of Cato. "Did you kill Kenyon Jenkins in order to promote the purposes of sex money murder?" Rolock replied, "No, to protect ourselves." He claimed that he had been threatened, and he made the same assertions concerning Carlton Hines. Questioned about the murder of Anthony Dunkley, he replied that Wallace had told him to kill the Jamaican because he feared that Dunkley would be arrested and flip, informing on them. Rolock revealed how Twin had killed Frisky, and finally he maintained that B-Love told him that Twin was going to testify against him. I was told by others that he was supposed to be a witness cooperating. I don't know to what extent. He said that the only person he had asked to carry out the hit on Twin was B-Love. Furthermore, he said that he had not directed the attempts on Twin's brother or the other man killed on Thanksgiving, Ephraim E-Man Solar. La Barbera was mildly surprised at how forthright Rolock had been about what he had done. There was no sign of remorse, but Rolock did at least admit guilt. The judge asked him about the formation of sex money murder. "What made you the leader?" Pete answered quickly. "It was respect." On the block, Pipe listened with sorrow as Pete's mother broke the news that he had pled guilty. Pipe had put money in Pete's commissary and given his mother as much as $1,000 every few weeks for herself. Ma Brenda had become increasingly fearful as the investigation wore on. She thought that federal agents had bugged her house and asked to meet with Pipe secretly in his car. She told him that she was going to be named in the indictment for accepting $40 in drug money from B-Love, information B-Love had given to federal prosecutors. She said that Pete had only pled guilty to avoid her being named in an indictment. The rumor spread through Soundview. Pete had only pled guilty to save his mother. "They used me to kill my son," she told Pipe. In fact, Peter Rolock's mother was never looked at in any way for prosecution. In May 2000, Pipe's parole officer told him that O'Malley wanted to talk to Pipe directly, though he reminded Pipe that he was under no obligation to agree. Pipe decided that he might be able to get some information from the feds, so a week later he took his seat in a bland conference room on the first floor of the U.S. Attorney's office. "You saw what happened to your brother and Pete, right?" O'Malley began. Pipe said nothing. "We know you're the leader now. You and Pete are close, but don't think Pete can't have something done to you to send a message to your brother." Pipe said he would kill anyone who tried to get to him first. Inside, though, he was certain Pete would never kill him, and O'Malley was wrong. Next to O'Malley sat a young, soft-spoken, red-headed man who Pipe thought looked like Richie Cunningham on Happy Days. O'Malley introduced him as Dave Burrows and said that he was an FBI agent. Straight out of college, he worked security investigations at a local bank, and from there he applied for the FBI and was transferred to New York in the middle of the crime epidemic in the late 1980s. He distinguished himself and was offered a post in C-30, the violent gang squad. O'Malley had brought in the FBI again, not only for the greater resources the agency offered, but also because of Burroughs's skill and low-key demeanor. O'Malley had told Burroughs that he thought the young OG could be flipped. He told him about Pipe's crazy and violent younger brother, Roe, for background. Burroughs would be using the RICO laws, along with conspiracy to distribute, to bring down the gang. He made his pitch gently to Pipe, appealing to his sense of reason. He was looking for confidential informants who wouldn't have to testify, but would just feed him information now and then. He made it clear that he wasn't offering a get-out-of-jail-free card. Even if Pipe agreed, he would have to stay absolutely clean while working as an informant. In return, he would be paid a few hundred a month. "If you decide not to help, that's fine," said Burroughs, "but I'm carrying on with my investigation anyway. It won't change that." Pipe signaled that he understood. "Think about it," Burroughs said. He saw in Pipe an intelligent man who probably would have been a success in any other career had he been raised in a different place. Pipe noted how Burroughs kept eye contact throughout. The man seemed honest. Pipe slept badly that night, turning the idea over in his mind. He knew that sex money murder was moribund, and that sooner or later the feds would come for them. But he made thousands a week, and they expected him to roll over for a few hundred? The thought of it infuriated him, and he was rattled to find himself even considering the offer. Perhaps if he worked with them, he could extract information on the 23 informants in the neighborhood that Pete had told him about. Then he could turn the tables to plot against the feds, or at least buy some time to figure out how to save himself. A few days later, Pipe discussed the scenario with Chantal. If she wanted to leave, he would understand. To be uncovered as a snitch would be dangerous for all of them. But Chantal was happy where she was. She liked the money he brought in and believed that Pipe was above suspicion as the OG. A few weeks after their meeting, Pipe signed the agreement with O'Malley. Burroughs gave Pipe a beeper and arranged covert meetings every few weeks. The first time they met, Pipe pulled up behind Burroughs's federal car in a red Honda on Compton Avenue, a secluded back street that pushed up against the southeast corner of Pugsley Creek Park. Pipe checked that the coast was clear and jumped in with the FBI agent. To show good faith, Pipe told Burroughs there was a gun stashed in an old car parked in the back of the Met Foods supermarket. Within half an hour, police units swept in and recovered it, hoping to link it to homicides. Pipe was shocked at how quickly the police moved on his call. In the early weeks, Pipe felt like a mastermind, playing both sides and seeking to protect his own. He started to probe Burroughs for information on informants in the area. Burroughs had expected this all along. He knew that informants usually had their own reasons for signing up. For some it was purely financial, for others, revenge. Still, he told him the truth. "We probably only have one other informant out here." Pipe had compromised himself for nothing. The few $100 he got from the feds, he tossed to Chantal to buy groceries. As time wore on, he continued to feed Burroughs tidbits of information. When a shooting over some petty beef was about to go down, he gave the feds information to enable them to stop it. And on it went, a slow cat-and-mouse game with diminishing returns for Pipe. Pipe and Nut set to work penning a song called "Living Life is Like a Suicide," a paean to Pistol Pete, who awaited sentencing in November. They recorded the track in a basement studio on Commonwealth Avenue. The track focused on hugging the chrome and blue steel, and in part on Ma Brenda's pain and the legend of Pistol Pete. "I seen the world through the pistol's eyes. Tell me why they want to see my homie die and sit back and watch his mother cry. To see the news, and they speak in many lies, on the streets we just bangin' to survive. To stop us, they use our moms to behead us." Nut, who came to the recording studio with two underage prostitutes he pimped out at Hunt's Point, reserved his greatest contempt for Forcelli and Tirado, who were now pressing sex money murder every day. Tirado, dressed in a black leather trench coat, frequently stopped Pipe on the block and threw him up against his car. "For fuck's sake, Benny," said Pipe under his breath. "You're making me hot." When Pipe ran into Tirado at the U.S. Attorney's office, Tirado told him that he was just trying to help with Pipe's cover. But Pipe didn't believe him. Nutt penned the song's chorus, "Fuck Benny Tirado, murder's a sport." The song got some play for a while in clubs in the Bronx. Pipe even performed at a showcase on the advice of a record label talent scout under the rap name Mastermind, a sly conceit and an allusion to his new roles on both sides of the law. A representative from the company wanted to sign him, but they didn't want Nutt. Pipe refused the deal out of loyalty, a decision he would come to regret. He and Nutt sold CDs for $5 at the Bronx Festival and in some of the stores on Fordham Road, along with T-shirts with Pete's image and the legend, "Certified Gangsta." On the back it read, "The View," over an image of a Glock with a suppressor. Pipe took a copy of the CD to the U.S. Attorney's office and left it for Tirado and Forcelli. Tirado was furious when he heard it, but O'Malley calmed him by saying that a shout-out like that meant he was doing his job well and getting under their skin. The song was played in the Violent Gangs Unit offices. Burroughs caught himself humming it on the way home from work. On Pipe's 23rd birthday, he sat on the gum-encrusted sidewalk outside Met Foods on Cozy Corner, listening to the music pounding out of the open doors of his Honda nearby. He mixed cognac and vodka in a giant tumbler. He looked out on the corner, his eyes glazed. This was the place where his whole life had unfolded. His mother's kidnapping, the drive-by shooting, his first arrest that led to prison, and all the other dramas in between. He lay back on the sidewalk. Pete was gone, despite his efforts, and all the original crew were in prison, most of them snitches. Was there anyone he could trust now? Was he making the right calls? The slightest error and he'd be dead. He never would have been caught slipping like this, drunk and lollygagging on the sidewalk, if Pete were still around. But today, he just didn't care. He passed out, blissfully. An hour or so later he woke up, clambered back into his car, and drove home, veering all over the road. When he came close to Chantal's apartment, he saw that two cars had parked on opposite sides of the road leading in, leaving a very narrow passage between them. He floored the car for a straight shot, pushed through, then tumbled out and shuffled upstairs to bed. The next morning, he couldn't remember how one side of his car got twisted, until it slowly came back. When Burroughs couldn't make his meetings with Pipe, O'Malley showed up instead. Pipe much preferred Burroughs. He hadn't forgotten his first meeting with O'Malley up north, and he disliked O'Malley and Tirado equally. The relationship thawed when O'Malley offered him the chance to meet with Rowe at the U.S. Attorney's office. The brothers saw each other for the first time in 7 years. Rowe had bulked up with prison weights and had a scythe-shaped scar on the left side of his face, the result of a prison slashing. They pounded each other on the back, grinning. They spoke about home, family, and what they were facing. Pipe's soul lifted. O'Malley had given him a gift. One day in Soundview, O'Malley pulled up in his sleek black federal car behind PS 69, directly across the road from his old alma mater, the place where he'd sold Christmas trees all those years ago. The bank where he'd seen the robbery was now a funeral home, the place doing a brisk trade in one of the most troubled areas of the Bronx. Pipe, dressed in a red leather Avarex jacket, dived into the back seat and lay flat on the floor. O'Malley piloted the car down to Clayson Point. He pointed out his old school to Pipe. The gangster couldn't get his mind around it. It seemed impossible that a white cop working for the feds had grown up in Soundview. As they headed down White Plains Road, O'Malley pointed out the simple house he had lived in as a boy. Pipe sat up to look. The oak tree O'Malley's father had planted was now a colossus. Spreading over their little house, it stood witness to the passage of time. Some of his friends had ended up in jail. Others became electricians, firefighters, or cops. It was hard to predict where life would take anyone, but today O'Malley had the OG of one of America's most dangerous gangs in the back seat of his car, a son of Soundview like himself. He nosed the car down toward a narrow, rutted back street lined with fishermen's cottages near the tip of the Soundview Peninsula. Pipe moved to the front seat. O'Malley worried about Pipe's safety. Every time they met, he asked Pipe if it was safe to talk here. "What the fuck you mean?" said Pipe. "This is white boy territory. We fine." O'Malley's concern touched him. O'Malley updated him about his brother and passed on a couple of messages. Their relationship had changed. While they were not friends, they weren't exactly enemies. To Pipe, the police had always represented the corrupt and repressive hand of the state. Ever since he could remember, they had torn his family apart. Some in the neighborhood felt that the poverty, the violence, the drugs, all of it was the result of the white man's efforts to keep them down, to quarantine them in squalor and deprivation. Some asserted crack had been brought to the neighborhood by the CIA and the government so that young black men would kill each other off or be sent to giant prisons run by white men. By rights, O'Malley and Pipe should be at war forever. But O'Malley started to assume a different aspect for Pipe. He knew the streets. He could read the currents, a knowledge Pipe thought a white man could never possess. O'Malley seemed to care about the neighborhood. For example, any time someone here got shot or stabbed, Pipe's phone would go off within 5 minutes. Somehow O'Malley knew. They discussed a recent shooting as they sat looking out of the car. "There could have been a kid or an old person there who got hit," said O'Malley. "I'm not going to lie to you, Pipe. Some of those guys out here are dirtbags, and some of them probably deserve what they get. But I never take joy from hearing that someone has been shot up. Never. It's not for me to judge how men have to survive in the street. You all have mothers, sisters, kids, daughters. We all have someone that cares about us." Pipe thought about his sisters, whom he had moved out of Soundview for their own protection. "I feel you, J.O.," he said, using a nickname he had come up with for the investigator. "My family don't live in the hood no more, so nothing ain't going to happen to them that could affect me. As long as I move the right way, I'll be fine." O'Malley nodded. He knew that if they ever found out that Pipe was informing, they would kill him. They turned to work. O'Malley needed Pipe to ID a couple of players from some photographs. When they finished, O'Malley shifted gears. "Wow, did you see that Tiger Woods the other day? He killed it at the Open." "J.O.," said Pipe with a weary frown, "do I look like the type of motherfucker to you that watches Tiger Woods?" The detective laughed, started the car, and drove Pipe back to the block. Pipe alighted from the car to see Scruff lumbering past, staring at them. The hair on his scalp tightened. On the block, Scruff probed, suspicious at what he'd seen. Pipe told Scruff that the man was his parole officer. "They got me on this gang parole ship, but this time he come to the hood and didn't have time to go to the office." Scruff knew better than to contradict the OG, and left it alone. Forselli was determined to bring down the remaining elements of the crew. He found Rolock's decision to plead anticlimactic, preferring a trial when all the work with the cooperators would come to fruition. There would have been great satisfaction in seeing the cooperators and the evidence in court, but at least the man was off the street. Forselli had been trailing the gangster X, the man who had gone into the hospital to confirm that Twin was dead, for some time. Bob Ryan had traced his wire transfers from Pittsburgh to his relatives in the Bronx. Forselli checked the addresses, but there was no sign of him. Then Ryan ran all the parking tickets for X around the Bronx River houses. He found him at 1609 East 174th Street. Strapping on a Glock, Ryan waited outside until he saw X's Nissan in the parking lot around 9 a.m. He called Forselli and other detectives for backup. When X went to leave, they blocked in his car and pounced. In the back of an unmarked car, Forselli read him his Miranda rights and asked if they could search his car and apartment. "Go ahead. You won't find anything," X said. They found a gun in the car, the one used to murder Barnes, and a Santeria candle in the trunk, with text on the side reading, "To keep away law enforcement." Ryan couldn't resist. He turned to X, standing on the sidewalk in handcuffs. "You know why this didn't work, don't you?" The gangster shook his head. Because you didn't fucking light it. Forselli then went after BMO. He had last been seen pitching crack on Webster Avenue and returning to a tenement building behind the Grand Concourse. Burroughs had tapped the phones. They waited for a suitable time to hit the apartment to make the arrest.